Steve.
Hey, Emma.
What do you do when you really like something?
You know what I do, Emma? I talk to all my friends about it. What do you do?
That's a great idea, Steve. I even tell strangers on iTunes how much I rate and review it.
What a great idea.
Good people give ears, since times are so hard. My song to the poor, it doth pay some regard. For trade being dead, I'm weaving out of four. But I hope in a few months, it will make ends for all.
We are on the brink of liberty. We demand that our suffering cease. Now is the time for action. Now! The corrupt order will come crashing down!
Hello, and what you just heard there was the trailer for the film currently in the cinemas, Peterloo by Mike Lee. My name's Emma Burnell, and I'm here as always with Professor Steve Fielding. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
So, as you've probably gathered by now, what we're going to talk about is the film Peterloo. Now, obviously, normally, if we were covering a film that was in the cinemas currently, we would offer spoiler warnings. But Peterloo is a historical film and pretty close to the record. So I don't think we need to offer too much of a, oh my God, you'll never believe what happened. Because while the events were shocking, they should no longer, 200 years later, surprise anyone. Steve, do you want to outline what happens in the film?
Well,
you're our historian.
As a designated historian in this, for those that haven't seen the film and might be thinking about going to see it, it's about a massacre. In fact, it's a massacre of democracy and anti-poverty protesters who gathered in Manchester on St. Peter's Fields in 1819. First of all, in the context of, you know, most ordinary people didn't have the vote. And secondly, it was a time of massive economic instability, unemployment, and high food prices, particularly prices for bread. So it was a demonstration that was accidentally or maybe slightly intentionally, but it was attacked by yeomen and soldiers. 15 people were killed, maybe 700 people were injured, because the gathering was huge. It's about 60,000 people were there. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge event. It's a pro-democracy demonstration that was suppressed by the authorities, and yet very little is known about it in terms of the wider population. I'm speaking to you 3 miles from the very scene of the massacre in Manchester, and I can tell you that most people in Manchester are very vaguely aware, if anything, aware about the actual events. So one of the reasons why Mike Lee, who is from Salford, which is some would cruelly call a suburb of Manchester, but it's in the Manchester, Greater Manchester area, wanted to make the film for many reasons. And one of them was, I think, to publicise the event and stress the importance of it and significance of it. And the bicentenary is coming up next year. And the People's History Museum, if I can put a plug in for the People's History Museum, the National Museum of Democracy that is based in Manchester, is also doing lots of things about Peterloo too. So in a sense, it's clearly very timely. It's deliberately timed for that. And so if you don't know very much about Peterloo, the film is a very good reason. Well, it's a very good reason to go and see the film. Whether it's the only good reason to see the film, that's something we might want to discuss. But that's my historian's job done for this podcast, I think.
Well, maybe not. I might have some follow-up questions for you. But maybe we'll get onto that after discussing the film. I mean, I think we had slightly different reactions to the film that may come from the fact that I knew a lot less about what was going to happen than you did. I mean, I kind of had a vague outline. There was a massacre. It was at a place called Peter something, and they called it Peterloo because it was just after the Napoleonic Wars. That was about as much as I knew. I knew who the protagonists were. Well, not the individuals. I didn't know who Henry Hunt was, for example. But I knew what the sides were. And I really, particularly the last hour of the film, when you get to the demo and then the massacre, I thought it was gripping and really well done. It's a film that could have done with 40 minutes worth edited off it, in my opinion. But the bits that I loved, I really loved. And I don't think you had quite as strong a reaction. Would that be fair to say?
It would be fair to say. I mean, I'd be interested to know what were the bits that you loved. But I should have liked it. I mean, I know, you know, historians that liked the film because it was talking, it was depicting history. Mm. And it was doing in a very kind of respectful way, in the sense that when I mean, there are a whole series of meetings and people just speaking, and it was all part from the history. It was all taken from the historical record. There isn't anything in the film that I could say didn't actually happen. Maybe the emphasis is slightly different, but it's authentic in terms of what it looks like. I mean, everyone seems to have brown teeth. And it gives every appearance of being realistic. There's been lots of historical research and all of that. And it's depicting something that I think should be kind of given a much greater salience, what happened at St. Peter's Fields. Because, I mean, I've taken in my time postgraduates around from Nottingham just as a visit to Manchester, and I've made a point of taking them to St. Peter's Square and to, you know, into the library where there's some stuff going on about the massacre. And when I talk to them about it, they kind of look at me like, you know, like, we've never heard of this. You know, what's going on? And many of them were international students. And if this had happened in another country, there'd be a square. Where it happened, the square would be named, you know, maybe Democracy Square. There'd be things made of it. This is like a really, you know, one of...
So I'm just realising that I've spent a lot of time in St. Peter's Square and never put the two together.
Oh, you didn't realise? Well, I think a lot of people in Manchester probably would never put the two things together. Yeah, that's where it...
That's where it happened, just by where conference is.
Yes, absolutely. The Labour Party's never made very much of it, but then nobody else seems to make very much of it. And there is a campaign in Manchester to have a proper sort of memorial. It's been going on for quite a few years. So this is just a long way around me saying I should be really keen for this film, but I was so let down. It partly because I think what happened is he was far too respectful to the past. And he wanted to get too many stories in. He wanted to get historical record. And so you get a lot of blokes talking stuff in meetings. And great, that actually happened. But where's the drama here? You know, isn't it a bit boring? You know, couldn't you do it in a more imaginative way? So I had kind of dramatic concerns because it was boring. I did feel like it was a long. It was a long film that felt longer.
It was. It sagged in the middle. Absolutely. I completely concur with that. What made up for me was the last hour, which I just thought was brilliant. You're right that you didn't need to have every meeting and every decision. It was like having the minutes read back to you a little bit.
Yes.
And I think also that didn't work so well juxtaposed with the central family, who I thought was a good narrative device. Yeah, you start with the young man on the fields of Waterloo, seeing the horror of the end of the war. Then he walks all the way home and is exhausted and arrives exhausted and should be, you know, there for a hero's welcome and is in fact there for, starvation and poverty, and things just get worse and worse and he can't get work. And Mike Leigh does that kind of small very well. I mean, that's watching Mike Leigh do an epic is a bit odd because it's not his normal genre. So I think what you have were elements of a classic Mike Leigh small family moments drama alongside what I thought was a very good last hour of an epic, just with too many branch meetings in between.
Yeah, and too many characters. Just yeah. too many characters. And no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the kind of the narrative arc, as people like to say, with that soldier who is on the, that's where it opens up. He's on the fields. He's on the field of Waterloo. He's kind of traumatized clearly by it, and it juxtaposes all the. I mean, the Duke of Wellington is paid by a grateful Parliament. I mean, shed loads of cash, I mean, an enormous amount of money. The nation is grateful to him, and yet this soldier, who was actually one of the ones that actually fought it, is completely ignored and, like you say, just wanders home. And then using his family is in theory a good way to sort of humanize the bigger picture. But I thought it was all a bit stereotyped. I mean, Maxine Peake, who, you know, around these parts in Manchester, she's like the saint of drama. And obviously one of Jeremy Corbyn's favorite celebrities. A lot is made of her role in here, but she's kind of a glorified Coronation Street character. I mean, she's it's one way to bring women in, and women are brought in, and women did play a role in the actual Peterloo, and that's made clear. But she's kind of like, I know what I don't know what I like, and I like what I know, and I'll say what I want to, and these men, they're all talk. And I just thought it was a very underwritten, stereotypical, this is what women, sensible women think, and it was. You know, I'm not having a go at it as an actor, but the lines were just very stereotypical. And then, of course, the soldier himself goes with his family to Peterloo, and well, we don't need to say what happens to him, but guess what? It doesn't end well. So there's a nice little story in that, but I think it was just overblown, bloated, and he wanted to cram in as much history as possible. And in the end, I thought this is like watching one of those 1970s. Because I'm old enough to have watched them, BBC schools things. All those.
It was a bit how we used to live, wasn't it? That was it. Did at moments I did feel it was a bit how we used to live.
Which I'm not knocking that kind of thing, but it's something to watch at school, something to watch at school, you know, and learn stuff. So that was my kind of takeaway from that. It was, and also I took because I saw it quite a while ago. At the premiere, and there was like done nationally. So the premiere was in Manchester, but there were lots of things going on in other parts. So I watched it in a cinema in Nottingham, at the Broadway, and took some students with me for free because it was part of their course that they could watch this film. So they watched for free, and I asked them afterwards what they thought about it, and they kind of looked at me like they knew that they thought. I wanted them to say how great it was. And they kind of looked at me with pity and just said, well, it was a little bit boring. So that was kind of my view too. It's just, I thought it was a lost opportunity.
I mean, I as I say, I do think you could do a better edit of it. You could take 40 minutes out and make it a much better film. It did sag, and it was just too long. People are making films too long at the moment. And I think if you make an epic now, there's this sort of sense that it has to be nearly 3 hours long. And it's like, no, make a better film.
Yes. Yeah. And yes, less is more. Less is more.
So I would mark it down on those things. But by the end, I was genuinely emotionally moved and I was gripped. I agree, too many characters was a problem. I didn't really understand, like, they didn't have enough time to develop the various storylines. So the Russell Povey stuff, who was he? What was that supposed to be? I don't understand that. What was going on there? He was a spy. You could have said we have spies without having this weird extra bit where Russell Povey wanders in, not very well credited. Julie Helmenhay is just randomly in there. She's not even named character. I've just looked it up on IMDb. And again, you know, if you're going to put someone as recognisable as her in a show, then you need to give them more meat. And if you're going to give them more meat, you have to take that meat away from someone else. That's how editing works.
No, there are a lot of good actors in the film. And they're I think they're mostly wasted. And yeah, I mean, the massacre, partly thanks to financing from Amazon, which is kind of ironic given the wider politics of the film, which we might want to discuss. thanks to the financing of it, the actual massacre, I mean, this sounds like, I'm just like looking at the massacre as an aesthetic event, but the massacre was, quite well done. But there were lots of characters who you didn't know who they were and they're being killed. And it was like, well, there's another one dead. But had the film had a bit more going on dramatically for it, there'd be people who'd be having their guts being cut up and you go, I know him. Yeah, I've seen him before. Oh, and it was just like random stuff in the end. So, and again, they just keep coming back to the dramatic failure. And my reference points, and it might have really informed how I saw it, just a couple of weeks before that, I saw Black Klansman, which is another film with a lot of politics going on. Spike Lee's, it was a real story set not in the distant past, but in the 1970s, which actually is like another country in the United States, about a black FBI undercover agent who goes into the Klan, or at least he does virtually through a white FBI agent. And it's a fascinating film. It's funny. It's dramatic. It's got real politics about it. It was a great film. And you learnt things. I mean, I didn't know very much about what the original story and everything. So you actually learnt stuff. And then I saw Peter Lou, which I thought is some dreary, literal, British period drama, and it's trying to make a point, and it's kind of hitting you over the head with how you should feel about it, because it's, early 19th century Britain, and some people like, MP Chris Williamson might say, just like today, was a very, highly inegalitarian society, deeply unfair. And one reason for the context, why did the massacre happen, was not so much they actually wanted to go out and start slashing at the protesters with their sabers, but they had such contempt for ordinary people, and the very fact that these people wanted, some kind of representation, the authorities considered, tantamount to treason. These people were not really, they weren't considered as ordinary human beings. These ordinary people, these working class people, they were inferior, subhuman, and that's something that Lee does bring out. Like I say, there was something going on, but it was so crude, and it wasn't hot. It wasn't, I didn't want it to be like that Mel Gibson film, Braveheart, which completely turned facts upside down. It was almost completely made up stuff about William Wallace and the Scots and against the English. Obviously, that's ridiculous. But Mike Lee went the other way, completely. And there is a middle way in between.
I mean, there was some human drama there that I was intrigued by but didn't feel like I got answers to, which is again why I wanted to, particularly to talk to you as a historian. So there was for example, the main orator, Henry Hunt, he doesn't seem like a very good bloke. He's not depicted as a very nice man.
Oh, well, I mean, if our listener wishes to look beyond, do a bit of their own research, E.P. Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class, a kind of classic text of social and political history of this period, is very, very good. And he, writing as a Marxist historian, he brings out the vanity of Henry Orator Hunt. I mean, he was like, I don't think he'd be like the equivalent of being a party leader.
Well, I got the sense that Mike Lee was portraying him as the liberal versus the socialist. He was your sort of preening liberal centrist guy, and Bamford and the others were your proper sons of toil socialists.
Well, I didn't think that, but he might have been. He might have been because that's the thing about the pro democracy kind of movement at this point in time. It was a combination of the middle class, industrial middle classes who didn't have the vote, and the working classes who didn't have the vote, and they were kind of aligned together because they were against the aristocracy, who did control everything. Mm. And Hunt was. He was a landowner from the South, but he was a political liberal. So, a bit like, I don't know why I wanted to say Jeremy Corbyn at that point, but somebody whose own material interests were with those,
Tony Benn.
The elite. Tony Benn, yeah, a much better comparison. Yeah, someone who should have been a Tory but wasn't and took the people's cause. But he was nonetheless, in reality, at least as far as E.P. Thompson is concerned, he was a vain guy. He was full of himself, you know, and they made a lot of things about his white hat so that people could identify him. And he was a blowhard. I mean, whether he was intentionally doing it or was my reading of it, I sort of kind of Aaron Bastani, in Bastani's own imagination about how he would be a leader, that kind of a person who is clearly in love with themselves and but is also sees themselves as identifying with the people. And it's kind of part of his vanity.
I thought there was an interesting moment where Bamford and the doctor, whose name is escaping me at the moment, try to introduce themselves at a meeting they've gone down to London to attend, and he just has no interest in the actual working classes whose cause he claims to be championing. And that's where I got that kind of class socialist versus liberal analysis from, I think, was particularly that moment. You know, if that's how he was introduced as a character by Mike Lee, I felt that there was a point being made there.
Well, that's the thing about the film. And you could say that's why it's good. And on the other hand, you could say that's why it's bad, in the sense that, yeah, you could take that as an interpretation, but it wasn't very clear what interpretation you were meant to take from that, other than he was just a vain person, a bit self-glorifying. So, yeah, that was legitimate for you to take that. But I don't know that that was Mike Lee's actual point, because it isn't very clear at various times what his actual point is, other than the ruling classes at this point in time were horrible and didn't care. And that was kind of summed up in the Prince Regent's characterisation, which was ridiculously cartoonish. I mean, I thought...
To be fair, my only comparison is Hugh Laurie.
Because I was thinking it could have stepped out of Blackadder, that Harry was done. And I don't, you know, I think where I was, the audience laughed at some of it, but I'm not sure if they were laughing. I'm not sure what the origin of the laughter was, but it was completely over the top. But so, you know, the upper classes are horrible. That's a takeaway. That's clear. And the poor people, you know, the family, you know, saintly Maxine Peake's family, they're horribly done to. And then, yeah, there are some people in the middle who you're not quite clear, you know, who are seemingly on the side of the people, and that they're on, you know, they're on the wagon, you know, at Peterloo, and obviously Hunt is one of those, and that they're middle class or well off, and you're not quite sure, you know, it's ambiguous what point is being made about them, but they do seem to be on the people's side for whatever reason, which of course is also historically accurate, because as soon as the middle classes got the vote in 1832, many of them, you know, basically then distanced themselves from the working class, and, you know, in the sense that, well, we've got the vote and our interests are now secure. So, but none of that was really made very apparent in the film. I mean, it's a lot of stuff going on. Historians would be able to go, oh, yes, that's what he means, and that's what it means. And the rest of the audience, well, you can interpret it as you like, really.
There were some other things that I thought were slightly odd. There was the bit just before the rally started, so you got this field full of people, and for some reason there's this about 5-minute sequence where a bunch of journalists turn up and stand on the platform, and I didn't understand the point that was being made there.
No, I didn't really, because I felt right. So for our listener who hasn't seen the film, the film culminates in the massacre, and then just after that, the very last scene is a couple of those journalists going, we need to tell the people.
Well, that's not quite the last scene. The last scene's the Prince Regent.
Oh, yes, saying, where is Manchester? Yes. But it's part of the concluding bit about the
the massacre. We will go and tell the truth. And what I wanted to ask you was, did they? Because there sort of seemed to be this inference that the guy from the Times was going to stitch them up. So I was wondering if what had happened and what was being told to me was that is exactly what happened, and then the Times went back and said it was a riot rather than a massacre.
Well, it is my understanding that journalists did, because the point about Peterloo, why is it called Peterloo, is because it was publicised and it was this kind of a scandal, and Shelley then wrote his poem, you know, about it, The Mask of Anarchy, from which the phrase "for the many, not the few," is kind of coined. And yeah, they kind of did. But again, a modern audience who wouldn't necessarily know about the context might think, oh, is he saying something about fake news here? Because again, it's not very clear.
No, it wasn't. That wasn't clear at all, I have to say, because I was kind of, because they kept sort of going, oh, we don't trust you, man, from the Times. Are you going to stitch us up? Are you going to stitch us up? And I was like, why? Well, I didn't see the dramatic point to that unless you were going to then show them being stitched up, which doesn't seem to have happened. I'll tell you one thing I was very surprised by, which was that the film ended on the Prince Regent saying, where's Manchester, basically. So clearly what they were demonstrating there, that it was a crisis that had reached London. It had been heard of in London, but there was no post text. There was no, and following the Peterloo massacre, X, Y, and Z happened. And eventually there was the Great Reform Act of 1832, blah, 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 blah. I was really surprised not to see that, not to have, you know, you've got this film, which, as you have said, sticks rigidly to historical detail, but then just leaves it at that point and leaves you wondering, well, what next? What if this is such an important point in British history, tell me why, you know, tell me what that led to. And that's something I really wanted to see.
Well, he actually, when he was interviewed after the premiere in Manchester, I stuck around for some of that and watched it. And he actually said he deliberately didn't do that.
Oh, really? Okay, what was his reasoning?
Well, because he wanted the audience to draw their own conclusions, which I'm not quite sure. I mean, I don't know what, you know, that doesn't seem to make. So it's asking the audience to do a heck of a lot of work. But what it also, I mean, but also I do have some sympathy with that, because I don't know if you ever saw Suffragette.
I haven't seen that. I'm a terrible feminist.
It's a terrible film. So it's not as bad as Peterloo in the sense that in terms of drama, there's more going on and it's kind of more crafted. But that ends on a slightly bogus note in terms of the funeral of, was it Emily, who's the one that died at the Derby?
Anyway, wanted to throw herself under the king's horse.
No, she didn't really throw. She stood in front, and then it was, yeah, she didn't really throw. But yes, her that died, and then the funeral is that ends the film, and then at the end, as the funeral is happening, she's a kind of sacrifice, a martyr to the cause of women's vote. Then it does have that, you know, and this happened, and then that happened, and then the other thing happened, which is a lot of it's bogus, because what it seems to be saying is directly because this woman put herself in front of the king's horse and died, then women were enfranchised. And that's bogus, because it's, you know, the First World War happened, you know. And so I think he was being in a sense kind of scrupulously, almost like a historian. He didn't want the people to
draw a direct line.
Yeah, because you know, history is a very complicated thing, and Peterloo was part of a process, but it didn't lead directly to the things that we might associate it with. Because actually, although there was a great big fuss at the time, and this is something that some people have said, so Peterloo actually didn't lead to anything, you know. I mean, it was forgotten. You know, things happened for other reasons, and it was an unfortunate event, but it didn't really, it wasn't the spark to anything. It was part of a wider process, which doesn't then make the film that interesting if you go, well, it's, you know, it's okay, this happened, but other things happened too. So that might have been why, but he said he did do it deliberately. But I think the lack of a steer, an editorial steer, was something that was missing. And I think that might have been because it overwhelmed him, in the sense that history overwhelmed him. And he wasn't, and as you've pointed out, he's very good at small groups of eccentric people interacting, but the bigger stage, I think it just got beyond him.
I mean, yes, except I keep going back to that last hour where that was the bit that, you know, the big stage in a small square, as it were, was, I thought, beautifully directed. Both the sort of optimistic parts where, you know, the crowd is surging and coming together, and the terribly awful parts. I mean, just, you know, there was no... I was surprised it got a 12A. There was one shot in particular which had me going, ah! You know, genuinely putting my hands to my face and stuff. You know, really, really quite harrowing stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, the massacre, like I said, you know, as an aesthetic event, a bit like the big battle scene in the last of the Lord of the Rings films. Yeah, it's great, you know, as a cinematic kind of spectacle, but I wasn't quite sure. again, I wasn't quite sure what the meaning, what we were meant to take from that, apart from, ugh, that's horrible. And isn't that quite tragic? And because actually the massacre itself is, you know, how is it explained? Why did it happen? Historians have kind of gone over the runes on that. And, you know, other than, right, there was that wider context that I mentioned that the film makes very clear that the authorities, you know, despised ordinary working people and thought they were almost subhuman, and the very idea they're all gathering together to be treated seriously like human beings was almost an affront. So there was that bigger context. But the yeomen were like shown drinking, so they were all, you know, a bit half cut. But the soldiers, and they were all volunteers, you know, they were all from the middle class, the local middle class. But the soldiers, they were not part of that initial assault. But the key moment in the massacre or why it happened is that that the magistrate had to read out the riot act to basically tell people they had to disperse. That was the law at that point. And the thing is that people didn't hear the magistrate read out the riot act. Now, if you know what you're looking for, then I don't know if that was something that you clocked.
Yes, no, I did clock that. I clocked that they read. What it felt like to me is they were showing that they had stuck by the letter but not the spirit of the law, in that they read the riot act out the window knowing that no one was going to hear it.
Well, I don't know that that was their intention. I couldn't say, and I don't know what historians say about that. But it was read out and people didn't hear it. And then out come the yeomen. And slashing and whatever, and they were all drunk. So it was kind of a kind of structured carelessness that led to the massacre. But also, you might have heard there was a soldier, because then the soldiers, the actual full time soldiers, are all stationed locally.
You seem to be trying to sort things out at least at first, and then it kind of just all gets bloody.
Yeah. The actual soldiers were, you know, I mean, one of the soldiers is heard saying, you know, this is terrible or something. And that's an actual quote from an actual person that was recorded at the time. So there's ambiguity in terms of how it all happened. But ultimately, you know, 15 people were dead and 700 were injured. So, I don't know if that was, everybody would have picked that up about what was the meaning of this. Because I don't know if you want to go on to this now, because obviously, there are people. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, in, you know, his leader's speech at Liverpool, he mentioned the bicentenary of Peterloo, and linked the Labour Party to the struggles, you know, of ordinary people, and of which Peterloo was part. And he actually made it very clear. He actually said, "And the Tories were responsible for it." Obviously, a very different kind of Tory, but that's not something he really explored. So. And there's been people like Chris Williamson and others who have kind of said, you must see this film, you know, quoted The Mask of Anarchy. And I'm thinking, well, what are you taking from this, this film? What relevance has Peterloo, the film, the massacre, got to present day policies, present day Britain?
Well, it shows the dangers of isolationism. Which I now understand the Corn Laws a lot better, which is helpful.
Yes. Which are I'm sure are actually explained in the film.
Yeah, explained very well, because I genuinely did. I knew there were laws about some corn, and they were bad, and people rioted, and that was about it. So yeah, actually having them explained in quite a clear way was that, yeah, you could take a subtle anti-Brexit message there if you wanted to.
Would you?
Yeah, isolationism is bad. We should, you know, we shouldn't. We should trade freely internationally.
Oh, but that's a neoliberal kind of take, isn't it? Because the Corn Laws, were basically Parliament imposed a tariff on the import of grain. Which meant that local, you know, British farmers, English farmers, I mean, the people that basically ran the country, the aristocracy, the landowners, could get a very high price for grain. And that meant bread cost a lot, and bread was a staple for working families. So it's actually, yes, it's anti-protection, but it's a liberal argument that we need free trade.
Yes. Yeah. I'm being slightly tongue in cheek in terms of the Brexit thing, but I think it does show maybe unintended consequences of laws that were there to protect certain sets of groups of people without thinking about the vast majority of others. I think that this is about, you know, the pursuit of the upper class interest at the, the dismissal of anybody else's interest being worth a light. He did have some interesting moments in terms of actually having that question from within. There were a couple of the magistrates in the room by St. Peter's Square who were saying, look, hang on, this is just going to go horribly wrong. This, you know, they just want to eat and work. And so I thought, you know, it wasn't quite as unsubtle as you've maybe painted it at times.
Well, yes, there are. Yes, you're right. There is a debate, isn't there? But nonetheless, I think the big takeaway is, you know, if you wish to see it in a certain way, he provides you with the material to do that. I'm just struck by the kind of comparison. You know, after Dunkirk, the film Dunkirk was released, there was a tweet that Nigel Farage did where it was him standing next to the poster for the film and saying, every young person should see this film. And I thought, why? You know, what's going on there? Obviously he was taking something from it that I wasn't. And Chris Williamson, the arch ultra more Corbyn than Corbyn knight, said the very same thing. Everyone should watch Peterloo. And I thought, well, what are you taking from that, mate? And other than making very direct and very crude comparisons between what was going on in the early 19th century and when people stood up, they were all cut down, and, you know, solidarity, you know, all kinds of activism has to be, you know, the thing we you know, whatever. The upper classes are out to get us. And then drawing that, you know, parallel between the world in which, the society in which we live now, and some of the rhetoric against the Conservatives, certainly on Twitter from certain kinds of people on the left, is insane. I mean, you know, that the Tories are evil, you know, that they have no moral standing. And obviously, in terms of some of the impact of some of their policies, there is some case for structured carelessness.
Just ask the UN.
Yes. But are they evil? I mean, but there is sort of, I think people like Williamson want to draw a direct parallel between, you know, the Prince Regent and Theresa May. And that's rhetoric, and that's obviously what happens, but it's kind of trying to impose a meaning or draw a meaning, which is there if you want to take it, in the same way that if you're Nigel Farage, you will see vindication for Brexit from a film about explosions on the beaches of Dunkirk.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we should allow Chris Williamson to decide whether any film is good or not, in the same way that we shouldn't allow Nigel Farage either. Is this slightly propagandist? Yes, but as you say, it's also historically accurate. Maybe I was more open to being propagandized than you are at the moment, but I came away feeling a bit more inspired than I was led to believe that I might.
Right, okay. But inspired by what? I mean, inspired to do what?
To do what, I'm not sure. But the solidarity thing, I think, the fact that I know that things did change afterwards. I wish they had done a bit more kind of and then, because I don't care if it's not entirely historical accurate and it doesn't go in a straight line. Yeah, you've complained there's not enough story. I'm complaining there's not enough history. we're flipping our roles today. But I do, the fact that I know that things can get better and that they did change, and the juxtaposition of the optimism and the massacre, I felt really moved me. As I say, sagged hugely in the middle. There didn't need to be quite so much covering of dull meetings in pubs. Someone's clearly not been to enough brunch meetings. But the bit at the end, I came away in tears. And, you know, what more can you ask for, really?
No, yes, that's true. And obviously maybe I'm judging it by a certain standard. But it's a film about Britain's past, which does explore the very real class antagonisms and class conflicts. And also, it isn't just about class, because, you know, the middle classes and the working classes are, in effect, in alliance in this. It's not just about, you know, the socialist working class or anything like that. But there is conflict. And it is depicting a history that is closer to what I at least believe to be what it was really like. And it is not, I mean, and this is the point, this is not at all like the Downton Abbey version of the past, in which the upper classes are all lovable and they want to look after us and everybody's happy. And so, I mean, I don't know what overlap there might be between a Downton Abbey audience and a Peterloo audience. I suspect that lefties will go to see Peterloo and be inspired. And Downton Abbey, you know, or people, you know, people of a certain political view or none will probably think, oh, that's all so lovely. And that would be that. And they won't go to Peterloo. So I would be interested to see what kind of an audience Peterloo gets, and whether it is just people like, you know, yourself, myself, and Chris Williamson, and all members of Momentum, and in which case that's kind of not the point. It would be good if others went to see it, but I don't know that they will.
Yeah, I think that is the biggest question mark for me. And it was the same we've discussed before. Ken Loach, that's it. Does anyone go and see I, Daniel Blake, who isn't already massively convinced that the welfare system is appalling and atrocious and that Theresa May is an evil person? This is my question. You know, I think Peterloo does a much better job at being a historical drama that could bring people in than I, Daniel Blake, than a Ken Loach film does. I started out watching it thinking about Sharpie. And if you have a bit of a thing for that period, which people clearly do because the Burma Corn novels sold like hotcakes, and it's not just Sean Bean in those trousers, although that does help.
You're objectifying Bean in a horrible way here. This is terrible stuff.
Shut up. He's lovely. Anyway, there is an appetite for historical drama. So I think that this film probably does a better job of making some political points through that, as much as Downton and Julian Fellowes do the same thing. You know, he's making a very different political point, but he's certainly making one. But yeah, for me, it worked. It did. It worked. It G'd me up as a socialist. There you go.
Well, I should just point out that maybe this is good news for you, that there is Sharp does deal with Peterloo in a fictionalized form, I should point out, which I haven't yet seen because I've never actually seen any of the show. Yeah, so I've got Sean Bean's trousers to look forward to. But
I mean, it's also very good drama. Sharp's really, really good fun.
Well, maybe we should do Sharp one day if there's any point. But there is he does tackle Peterloo, but it's one of the very few fictional depictions of Peterloo, which again indicates its lack of impact. It's unknown. So if only for that. I mean, I do welcome Peterloo with lots of reservations. But if you want to know more about the period and you don't mind feeling a little bit bored, and like you say, sags in the middle, I'd say go. Forget what I'm saying. Just watch it for yourself.
There you go. There you go, listeners. I think that's probably a good note to end on. We will be back next month with our Christmas special slightly earlier, because obviously we usually release our episodes on the 25th, and we suspect that you will be too busy eating chocolate and turkey and mince pies to listen to us prattle on. As always, if you have enjoyed this, please do rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Tell your friends. Tell us. We are at ZT Podcast on Twitter, and I am at Emma Burnell _. And Steve, you are at Pol Prof Steve, is that right?
I think so. Yes, I'll have to talk to my agent, yes, to confirm that. Yes, I think I am, yeah.
Great, lovely. Well, we will see you at Christmas, listeners. Thank you very much.